From Buddhist teacher Sharon Salzberg's Loving Kindness, The Revolutionary Art of Happiness. A meditation master from Thailand's forest tradition came to visit the United States several years ago. After just a short time here, he said, rather bemusedly, "In Asia, the classical sequence of the teachings and practice is first generosity, then morality, and then meditation or insight. But here in the United States, the sequence seems to be meditation first, then morality, and then after some time, as kind of an appendix, there's some teaching about generosity. What's going on here?" The Buddha himself always started new practitioners by teaching them dana, the practice of generosity. Generosity is the inception of the path. It is often true that we Westerners prefer the enticement of transformative spiritual states. We understand the need for effort toward that end and are willing to put it forth. However, the actual springboard for those spiritual states is the cultivation of these qualities, which allow all other states to unfold more easily and most gracefully and simply. Generosity has such power because it is characterized by the inner quality of letting go or relinquishing. Being able to let go, to give up, to renounce, to give generously, these capacities spring from the same source within us. When we practice generosity, we open all of those liberating qualities simultaneously. The path begins here because when we practice generosity, we begin to know a very beautiful quality of joy, a sheer, unhindered delight flowing freely. Giving brings happiness at every stage of its expression. We experience joy in forming the intention to be generous. We experience joy in the actual act of giving something. And we experience joy in remembering the fact that we have given.
Good morning again. So, as Americans, we have a bit of a giving problem. Well, maybe it's the opposite of a giving problem. Maybe it's a giving away problem. Americans have too much stuff. The LA Times reported that the average American household contains 300,000 items. 300,000 items. And while the size of American homes have tripled over the past 50 years, Americans still seek out more places to store their stuff. The storage industry has become a $38 billion business, the business of housing possessions that we don't need every day, but we can't let go of. So lately, my own family has been confronted with this problem in a sort of temporary way, which many of us think can relate to. So when death comes into our lives, even when it is expected, we're often left not only coping with the grief, but with the issues and affairs of our loved ones, including their stuff. I saw some nods. So this has been my reality for the past month or two, in two ways. So my father and his sisters have recently been sorting through a whole household of items. I can imagine maybe 300,000, but who knows, of my wonderful grandmother, who was 93 and recently passed away just a few weeks ago. And it was unexpected and sad, and yet she had lived such a long and wonderful life. And she died exactly as she wanted to, in her own home, in her own bed, with her dog next to her. And while she had left detailed records of what to do with her finances and affairs, she had no plan for what to do with her whole house full of stuff. And so my father and his two sisters were left literally flipping coins, going through each plate, each set of silverware, each painting, each set of china, to see who wanted each item and who had attachment to it, and which items that they could save for other family members and which items they could let go of. And he talks about how painful this process was and how surprisingly emotional. Even though the stuff didn't have emotional attachment, just the process of going through it was so grueling. And then in my own life, my spouse and I have been sorting through the items and possessions and meaningful nostalgia from my spouse's mother, Sam, who was living with us for 9 months in her final chapter of her life with Alzheimer's disease. And Beverly was living next door to us, and so we had set up an entire home for her. And so over the past month, we've been sorting through all of the possessions, and when you look at a whole life, there are actually just a small corner of items which have a lot of meaning. And for each family, that can be different. It can be photographs or loved items that have been family traditions or heirlooms or letters or particular signature items of clothing. For Beverly, she had these beautiful hats, and so we can't part with the hats. But surprisingly, most of her possessions simply feel like stuff without meaning. And so it's been our task to find the items that have meaning and then to figure out what to do with the items that don't, which are most of the items. So we spent many days sitting in a kitchen full of pots and pans and plates and bowls and wondering what to do. And some people might be familiar with the stuff guru Marie Kondo. Have you heard of Marie Kondo or watched her wonderful Netflix show? And so she has this question that she encourages each person that she works with to ask about your stuff. Does this bring me joy? Does this bring me joy? And so the answer for most of the stuff was no. There was no joy. And so what we did was to think about how we could bring more joy to this process. And for us, that was to join a national movement that's called the Buy Nothing Project. Have you heard about this? So there are lots of local chapters of people who have either Facebook groups or online groups where they give things away. And sometimes you ask for things that you need or want. And so there's this matching process that happens with real life neighbors. The group offers members a way to give and receive, share and lend, and express gratitude through a worldwide network of micro-level gift economies, they call it, in which true wealth is the web of connections formed between and among people. So after stacking up a perfectly good set of pots and pans, I saw an ask that a local mom had put on the Buy Nothing group. She said, "Both my husband and I have found ourselves unemployed, and we're down to our last pan. Does anyone have a set of pots and pans?" And so how gratifying it was to be able to offer that so freely and to serve a real need. So I started to give more and more things away. And like a secret Santa, I would leave some items on doorsteps. My favorite was several cases of Ensure. That for me, it was just a reminder of how difficult times were in the end with Beverly. And yet, that Ensure was so life-giving for a neighbor who couldn't afford it. So each time I gave, it made me want to give and give again and to give more. And it's helped to make the world just a little bit smaller in a hard time, and friendlier, and to understand my neighbors and neighborhood and people's real needs. So I've been thinking a lot about our American cultural attachment to stuff. And I've been thinking about our Unitarian Universalist communities. We are congregations full of generous people who give of ourselves in so many ways. And simply in this service, we can see just a few of those opportunities: giving canned goods, giving money, giving inspiration and a message of hope. I'm wondering what is happening in your life, ways that you are giving, great and small, whether that is of your time or your resources or your stuff. And how are you mindfully approaching this American problem of giving, of mindfully filling our homes and our lives with possessions that we need? And when and how do we discern what is too much or what we don't need? And how do we then channel what we have to serve those who could truly benefit? I've also been thinking about what sacrifices we're willing to make. After all, as I've learned well over this past month, it's really easy to give away other people's stuff. But it's much harder to give away things to which we have become attached. Years ago, I traveled to Puerto Rico for my father's 60th birthday. And he was partnered with a woman there for a long time who was a well-known physician. And I was a guest in his home, in her home, for this birthday celebration. And she employed a woman full-time, as was customary in that city. And she was the most incredible cook, the most generous and amazing cook I had ever experienced. And my Spanish wasn't great, but I wanted to tell her how grateful I was for the hospitality that she had provided to us. And I also wanted to compliment her on her style, because she had wonderful style. And so I said in my broken Spanish, "I love your shoes." She had these fantastic red sandals, kind of platform shoes, and I just thought they were amazing. And so as we prepared to leave, I found the sandals outside my door. I was dumbfounded. This woman probably didn't have very many pairs of shoes at all, and she had chosen to give me this beautiful pair of shoes that she was obviously very proud of. And I had so many pairs of shoes at home, and yet I knew that to take the shoes and receive the gift was a part of what she had intended. So I took the shoes with me back to New York, and I wore them proudly, and I told everyone about this experience. But boy, did I wish that I had given her something from my suitcase. Not a superficial gift, but something that was a treasure to show her that appreciation. So it's just an example that that cultural instinct to give was not wired within me, but it was wired within this woman. So to go back to that reading, Sharon Salzberg, whose teachings I have followed and whose retreats I have participated in for many years, she talks about the teacher of the Thai Buddhist tradition, the Insight Buddhist tradition, in her interpretation, who wisely pointed out our American cultural problem with giving. That we think of it as sort of the last stop in living a good life, in being a good person. And in the Buddhist paradigm, giving is actually at the beginning. It's the first step. It's the first thing on the path to living a good life.
and to being a generous person and being a person of faith. So that difference is subtle. But in the Western paradigm, in American culture, I think we often think about giving not as a regular practice, but more as accumulating as a regular practice. Throughout our lives that we continue to collect and in many ways to aspire to bring more and more possessions and more resources into our lives. And giving is done more as a response. When we are asked to give, we often hear that language in volunteering that we're giving back. That we have accumulated so much, we're so grateful that we live such good lives, and so we're giving back as a response. And in religious communities, that paradigm can also express itself. A church stewardship guru says that giving is what we do for ourselves in response to all we have been given in our lives. And so when we hear that, it doesn't necessarily sound wrong to us. It sounds, yes, that's what we do. But I think when we can just start to question and to open up these cultural ideas a little bit about generosity, it helps us to find a balance. As an American Buddhist, Sharon Salzberg talks about how that tension manifests within herself. And she has a practice of giving that I think is really interesting for us to think about what that would mean for us. She says if one thought comes into her mind to give something away, whether that's money or possessions or, I don't know, anything else, a connection, time, when the thought comes into her head to give, she tries to follow that thought. She tries to make good on her own thought. And she tries to give as fast as she can before she tells herself why she can't. She says usually her next 50 thoughts are, oh no, I can't do that. I might need that. And she is just like us, just this advanced spiritual teacher, and yet in our American culture, we are ingrained that we might need things. If we give something away, we might not have it. And so she tries to be faithful for this instinct within her to be generous. What holds her back and what holds many of us back are those cultural attachments that we're probably all too familiar with. Attachments to our possessions, to our money and our resources, even our time, maybe our space, our household, that we're protective of what we have. And sometimes we fear that if we give things away, that we'll be left without enough. That we'll be left without enough. Of course, there are many of us who live with real constraints in our lives. And this is not to minimize those constraints. There are many of us who live on fixed incomes and fixed budgets. There are many of us who can't predict from week to week or month to month or year to year how much we'll have to give. But what is true is that many of us have to give more than we think we do. We have more to give than we think we do. And if we don't have the money we think we have to give, maybe we have space. Maybe we have a beautiful home that we can gather people in or that we could use to house a person or to invite a gathering that would draw community together. Or maybe we have time to give to the fellowship or to this community. The times when we are truly inspired to follow that instinct, when we think we want to give something, and then we follow through with that instinct, that is the time when we can clearly experience that channeling, that giving, that freedom of being in connection with our true self and our values. That is the beginning of the path. as the Buddhists call it. That is the practice of generosity. The more we give, the more we want to give, and the freer and more loving we are. Sharon Salzberg says that it has such power because it has this inner quality of relinquishing, of letting go. Being able to let go, to give up, to give generously, this springs from the same source within us. We experience joy in forming the intention to give, in being generous, and the act of giving something. We experience joy in remembering the fact that we have given. So in many of our congregations, and your administrator and minister tells me that it's not yet stewardship season, but it's coming up. It's the time of year when we're talking about generosity in our spiritual communities. And boards and ministers worry so much about the future of our congregations when we're planning budgets that depend on our generosity. And members of our congregations worry about their finances and planning pledges. They worry that they won't have enough to give, or if they give too much in the form of a pledge, they might not be able to fulfill that pledge. And not all this worrying is unwarranted. Many of our congregations have big dreams. Each year, our budget expresses our values and our mission, and we have much we want to do. We want to add more music. We want to add more staff. We want to bring more people into our programs. We want to help families. We want to help our community. We want to help our democracy. We have big dreams. And so not all this worrying about what we'll have is unwarranted. In fact, it's important to consider the reality of what we can do, what is possible, and then what are our limitations as well. Also, it's an incredibly difficult time in our world, and many of us feel pulled in lots of different directions to give. I don't know about you, but I get 5 or 6 text messages every day asking me to give to one campaign or another. And Tuesday is coming up here in California as a big day when a lot of us are voting and making some big decisions. And so a lot of us are channeling our resources and our time into helping our democracy right now and helping our state be a model for that democracy. We have all of these causes that we want to align with, and we want to align our resources and our generosity with our values. So now is a good time before that stewardship campaign starts in earnest, and there's no one up here actually asking you to pledge, which there will be in just a month or two. This is a good time for us to take a deep breath together, because talking about money is hard, and talking about giving is hard. And to remind ourselves that the path towards the future, whether that's our own future or the future of our communities, is filled with joy and freedom in the practice of giving, which has countless ways to be expressed. And each of us has within us that inherent goodness, that inherent instinct to give of ourselves to who we love and what we love, and to sustain the tree of life for ourselves and for generations to come. May it be so, and amen.